Okay, everyone. What's the date? Today's the 20th, right?
20th of March. There you go.
March 20th. Very good. Okay, everyone. Great to be here again. We have a few weeks before Pesach. Just a few things I want to show you before we start. We spoke last class about differences between the Rav in Boston and in New York. There's an interesting article. You can see it online. Just this is at least the past Rebbetzin of Hollywood, Florida. And she discusses some of the differences, the way the Rav related to in the Shiurim. You know, those who are in a Shiur know that he could be a taskmaster, especially in the 50s and early 60s. But it was very different with the Boston Balabatim. This came in the mail today. I'm just calling your attention in case those of you who don't know about it. Oh, hold on a second. I want to have my other computer going too as well. The new Chakira. Now, I mention this because there's actually stuff from the Rav in here. And the new tradition that'll be out soon, it's the 30th anniversary of his Yahrzeit. There's going to be, I think, a whole issue devoted to him. And some of the letters we're dealing with, they asked me, the Hebrew ones, could they translate them into English? So I said, yes. Now, this has in here lectures of the Rav transcribed for the first time, and also a hesped for Rav Moshe Dovber Rifkin. He was the Chabad Rosh Yeshiva at Torah Vadas, or one of the, I don't know if they called him Rosh Yeshiva or Rebbe, that the Rav gave the hesped for. So that's very interesting. There's also an article by myself in here that deals with the Rav to a little bit. It's called, quote, Truth and Authorial Intent in the Study of Torah. Basically, when we give explanations, let's say we give an explanation of the Rambam, are we saying that this is what the Rambam meant? Historically, or is that really not that important? That is, Torah grows on its own and through chidushim, and a chidush could be something entirely new that's inherent, that's latent in what the Rambam said, but it isn't actually what the Rambam or what any other Rishon meant. So I present my thoughts on this, and then there's a response to it. So let's put this aside here. Three more things. Okay, we're going to the last class. Someone wanted to, what do I mean when I said that the Rambam didn't paskin, that Reb Chaim didn't paskin? I don't mean to say that he never gave halachic decisions, especially on big issues of the day, but on general day-to-day things, he had a dalyan. Now, why didn't he paskin? There's different speculation on this. Rav Zevin thinks that, because he had a whole different conception, him poskening would have overturned halacha the way we know it in many areas, and he wasn't prepared to do that. So maybe for his family he did, but for the community as a whole, he didn't. We know, for instance, that when he wanted to ask a shayla, let's say, about, let's say, an aguna, Rav Yitzchak Hanan, Rav Zevin reports, he just wanted the answer. He didn't want the explanation. So that's what I mean by poskening. Now, Jonas says, I also said that he didn't give drushas at all. Jonas says that he remembers learning Sanhedrin with the Rav, and the Rav mentioned Rav Chaim gave two public shiurim a year, Shabbos Shuv and Shabbos HaGadol. Then Jonas mentions that the Rav quoted what I said, that Rav Chaim would allow kids to ride on his back, and someone in the audience got up and shouted, "You're being mevaza talmid chachamim," and he was hustled out. And Jonas remembers this from Yahrzeit Shiur. I mean, the idea, by the way, that the Rav could be Mevaza, his grandfather, if there's anyone that the Rav idealized, even more than idealized, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg says that when the Rav speaks about his grandfather, it's like people in a cot speak about their leader. And he gave the example of Chabad. Just like in Chabad, you speak about the Rebbe, so too, he says, the Rav, when he speaks about his grandfather, it's that way. But so when did I get this? I said the Rav didn't... that Reb Chaim didn't darshan. Well, I saw this in Brisker type of sources, but I doubted it. I questioned it. By the way, in the book The Rav Speaks, page 113, the Rav mentions that his grandfather, when he delivered his first Shabbat Shuva drasha, and he quoted something he said. But I had read that he never did this. So I asked Rav Golevsky. In fact, hold on a second. I should have pulled this up because I think you'll find this interesting. Let me see. I have a picture here of Rabbi Golevsky. Just a second. I took a picture when I was at his house, and I'll tell you who Rav Golevsky is in a second. Hold on. Let me see if I can quickly pull it up. Ah, yes. Okay. So let me share my screen here with you. Here's Rav Golevsky. Some old-time YU people might remember him because he taught at YU. He's from Brisk. His grandfather was Rav Simcha Zella Grieger, the Dayan of Brisk. I took this picture. I took another picture of him. This is on his wall. So you have on the left Rav Chaim, and on the right, that's Rav Simcha Zella Grieger, who was murdered in the Holocaust. So I asked Rav Golevsky this question. Rav Golevsky, him and Rav Steinman were, Rav Steinman passed away before him, and Rav Golevsky, I think, was the last person who could remember the Torah, passed away a few years ago, remember the Torah water brisk. So I asked him this question. Is it true that Rav Chaim never gave drashas? He says, absolutely. He said, maybe in the first few years, Rav Chaim gave drashas, and that could be what the Rav is referring to. But he says that after the first few years, and this is something that he, as someone from Brisk, he knew that he didn't give drashas and Rav Elvel didn't give drashas either, that that's not what Rav Chaim did. So if you want to know where I got it from, it comes from, I saw it in print, but it comes from Rav Dov Ber Golevsky. Okay, let's pick up now. We have important things to do today, including one issue that really had a good deal of impact on the reputation of one rabbi in particular, and it's a big issue. So let's get right to it. I got all my stuff here. By the way, I don't know if anyone here is on their Shul's education committee. The Shul I thought I was going to be at in Shavuos doesn't look like I'm going to be there anymore. So if anyone wants more of regular talks as opposed to these freewheeling ones, we got that as well. Okay, we're picking up letter 16. A couple small letters till we get to the big one that's going to have to spend a lot of time on. And I hope that some of you maybe can help me because I have trouble with that letter. The letter 16 is a not such a significant letter. I found it, but I thought it was worth publishing. By the way, I have I'm also transcribing now something that no one knows about. Talks that the Rav gave that I have copies. So that I hope to finish that. As well as I mentioned, I have an unknown article from the Rav. But first, we got to finish what we're doing here. Okay, so the letters are to two people. The first person is to, it's letters in honor of two people. One is Yitzhak Raphael. Here you see him now. He was one of the leaders of the Mafdal. He was also a member of Knesset. He ran Mossad Rav Kook, but a big religious Zionist leader. Oh, wait a second. The other one, let me pull it up again for you. Mizrahi was honoring two people. And the other one is this man, Shlomo Zalman Shragai. He was actually the first mayor of, Jerusalem, an old Mizrahiite. He was only mayor for a short time. The first Jewish mayor of Jerusalem. He was an Ishbitzer, Chassid, or a Radziner, I should say, but a leading Mizrahi figure, lived a long life. So the Rav was asked to, by Rabbi Kirschblum, they were honoring both of them. What could he say about them? And it's just a nice letter talking about how valuable each of them are. Each one of them, he says, gave great value Truma Gadola Letznuatenu. You know, if it wasn't for them, who knows where our movement would have reached. So just you see in this just strong support, you know, for Mizrahi leaders. The Rav never wavered from his support for Mizrahi. And in his lifetime, I mentioned that created controversy even after his death. It's amazing if you go around today. I meet Hasidim who have, they tell me they have a whole bookcase full of the Rav stuff. I meet people from Europe, Haredi types, that are very much into the Rav. How is that possible? You know, the Rav was so controversial in that world because I think it's for a couple of reasons. First of all, today that dispute is finished. Yes, there was a dispute over Zionism, but at the end of the day, is anyone, unless you're Satmar, isn't everyone going to acknowledge the state of Israel has done more for Torah study than anything? I mean, it's the center of Israel, the center of Jewish life now. So if you look at where we are in 2023, of course the Mizrahi approach was the correct approach in the sense that if the state is coming, you're either going to support it and be involved with it and try to influence it, or you're going to ignore it. And even the Haredim today, the Aguda, Degel Torah, all of them, they relate to the state of Israel practically like the Mizrahi did. They don't have Yom HaTzma'ut and all that, but it practically, how they relate to it, involvement in it, it's not like the old Aguda. It's very much like the old Mizrahi. Furthermore, from speaking to all these people, you know, as I said, today the old disputes seem to be finished, and the Rav has many Talmidim who are in that world, so they brought his Torah, but I hope I don't come off as a triumphalist when I say this, because I'm not. I'm not a Talmud of the Rav in that sense. But I just think it's the honest thing to say that at the end of the day, if all you're interested in Shas and Poskim, you don't need the Rav. It's nice to have the Rav. His Chidushim are of the highest level, even unique. But there's other great Rosh Yeshiva that you can study. But what I say now, and I say it without fear of being contradicted, if you want to have a sophisticated understanding of how Judaism responds to issues of the modern world, just like you need to look at Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, and just like you need to see what Rav Kook says, you need to look at the Rav. You can't consider yourself an educated, sophisticated Jew. When I say educated, I mean educated in the issues of modernity, all these things. If you're not interested in that, it's fine. But if you're interested in that, if you want to speak about how Judaism has an impact on the world and changes in the world, in science, humanities, all these areas, if you want to have an appreciation of that, you can't ignore the Rav. That doesn't mean you have to agree with everything he says, but you need him. So it doesn't matter what school you're in, what circle you're in. You have Reformed Jews, they read the Rav. You have Christians. There's a Jesuit priest in Switzerland. What's his name? Christian Ruthauser, I think his name is. He published a whole book on the Rav. He says he's not into, halacha is not for him, but if you're interested in issues of faith in the modern world, I mean, everyone's going to go to the Rav. So it's really amazing. Okay, let's turn to now. Letter 17 is a short letter, also a short letter to Shragai, the Shlomo Zalman Shragai, who, by the way, was very interested in Techelos before Techelos was fashionable because he's a Radziner. Now, unfortunately for the Radziners, we know that the Radziner Techelos is not the correct Techelos. I hate to say it, but it's true. The Radziners have been, they've been using their Techelos for over a century, but it's not authentic. The Techelos we have today, and if you haven't been, I highly recommend it. I think it's by Zichron Yaakov. You can go snorkeling and you can pull out the snails. They have a whole movie and exhibit. They show you how to get the Techelos out of the snail. It's nice. Good to take your children or your grandchildren on that. But the Radziner Techelos, there's no question it's not the true Techelos. But he was very interested in it. We see he sent the Rav the book on the Techelos. But this is just a letter. Oh, we don't know what the Rav was responding to in this letter. It's just that someone attacked Shragai, presumably someone in the Haredi world. So Shragai sent this article, which I wish I knew which article it was, to the Rav, and the Rav says, I read it. There's nothing wrong with what you said. What you said is totally in line with Derech Munav Mesora. And he says, don't ignore these people. All they do is complain. We all know that how much you've done for the Jewish people when it comes to Taras Am Yisrael and issues of Yichus. And he basically says, ignore them. Okay. Dice letter, not the most important, but we get a sense for the Rav, his support for people that he thinks are being incorrectly criticized. Okay. The next letter is a big one, and it's going to take us way beyond the letter and it's going to deal with the Rav's relationship with another very important man, none other than Rabbi Emanuel Rachman. This is a picture taken. Rachman lived a very long life. He lived to 98 years old. I think this picture it's definitely in his 90s. And the Rav and Rachman were close. For many, many years, they were close. In fact, it's fair to say that, by the time you get to the 1960s, you have Rav Lichtenstein, you have Walter Wurzburger. I think Larry Kaplan in an article refers to Walter Wurzburger as the Rav's intellectual lieutenant. You have Norman Lamb. They really could present the Rav's positions. But in the 1950s, you have a beleaguered modern orthodoxy, a weak modern orthodoxy. Conservative Judaism is the wave of the future. And you have a few important rabbis standing in the breach, and one of them is Emanuel Rachman. He's not a student of the Rav, although he calls the Rav his Rebbe. He's before Rabbi Soloveitchik at Yeshivas Ritzel Haran. And he's very close to the Rav, and he publishes a couple articles which are quite influential in the 50s. So, for instance, let me show you one. This article really introduced the Rav to American intellectual circles. Commentary, June 1952. Orthodox Judaism moves to the times, the creativity of tradition. This article focuses on Rabbi Soloveitchik. To a certain extent, the Rabbi Rachman introduces Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was a Rosh Yeshiva, who in the Yeshiva circles, they knew him. But the wider Orthodox circles, wider American intellectual circles did not know him. Rachman also wrote a few important articles on halacha, defenses of halacha, understanding of halacha, which he wrote in consultation with Rabbi Soloveitchik. In the Helfgott volume, there's a letter where Helfgott says to an unknown correspondent, the letter is to Rachman, and it's a discussion. The Rav is giving his position on certain matters that Rachman is going to discuss. And Rachman, of course, I have a family connection, and that he was Masader Kiddushin at my wife's parents' wedding, because my wife's grandparents were members of the shul, Shari Tvila in Far Rockaway. I don't think that shul would allow Rabbi Rachman to speak anymore, but my wife's grandfather was the president of the shul when Rabbi or great-grandfather, when Rabbi Rachman was brought in. So he was a very important figure. He was in Far Rockaway and in Fifth Avenue Synagogue. He was also at YU, not just teaching there. He was, was his position provost, assistant of the president, I forget. So a very important figure, so important that I think he's worthy of a biography, which we don't have yet. And maybe if we had this biography, some of the questions which we're going to deal with now could be answered. Unfortunately, we have a book on Yeshiva University written by, we have Gilbert Klapperman's book, but we also have Jeffrey Gurek's book. I can't explain this other than maybe because Jeffrey Gurek was assistant to Lamb at the time, but he wrote this book on YU, and he doesn't deal with the controversy over presidency of Yeshiva University. There was really two models here, either Rachman, who was the older, more distinguished person who you might have expected, although some of his ideas maybe were a little bit, even by then, a little bit radical. In fact, the letter we're going to talk about in a minute, some people have claimed that this letter from Rabbi Soloveitchik, or this speech, which the letter is a reflection of, doomed Rachman's candidacy president of YU. But it would be great to know what went on the inner circles, how they decided to give it to Lamb, presidency of YU, not to Rachman. Rachman, after he doesn't get it, he goes to Bar Ilan and becomes chancellor at Bar Ilan. Now, I know a good deal about Rachman simply because, not just because I read stuff, but because after and I'll say this to preserve it for posterity. After my book on Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg was published, Rabbi Rachman contacted me. He wanted me to do a biography. He liked the book on Weinberg. He even wrote a review in the Jewish Week. And he wanted me to write a review of a book about his life. So that sounds interesting. You know, you could write the history. I thought you could write the history of modern Orthodoxy in America. That's sort of what I'm going to do, hope to do now, my next project. But that wasn't, you know, they're asking me. So, you know, I have to put aside the other things I'm going to do. So we worked out a whole plan. I said I would need to take a year off because of school. I would need to be funded. I thought this might, you know, give me a chance to look at the history of American Orthodoxy. So we came up with a whole plan that that Rabbi Rachman had admirers, that they would come up with a whole financial package. I could take a year off. And I would, I had an attorney write up a whole contract. I get one third of it at the beginning, one third when the manuscript was done, and one third when it appeared. So it was very interesting. And I met with Rachman. He gave me materials. All was ready to go. And then right before I'm about to start it, we have another conversation. And he's planning out how it's going to be. So he says, well, after each chapter, I should send it to him and he'll have his comments. And then I said, but wait a second, we have a problem here, because I'm happy to write a biography, because I think to tell the story of American modern Orthodoxy, the controversies in Rachman's life is very interesting. And I could, just like I did with Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg, I could tell the story of what's going on in Germany and Lithuania through his life. I could do that with Rachman. I said to him, though, but this is, I don't want to write an authorized biography. I want to write a real biography. So I can't give you the chapters and have you then give your comments and me, you know, this isn't an authorized biography, even if you're paying me. You know, when I deal with this issue of the Beistin that he set up, and if I want to say that there's no halachic basis for what Rachman was saying, I want to be able to say that. I wasn't going to write an authorized biography. So our plan, our collaboration broke down over this. And I understand if he's coming up with the money, and I understand why he would want an authorized biography. There's nothing wrong with that. But I wasn't going to do an authorized biography, at least at that stage of my career. I wasn't going to be bound by that. But I had this connection to Rabbi Rachman, and I knew him. Now, the story I'm going to tell you now is... it's a bit unfortunate, sad, I think, because the event, well, has cast Rabbi Rachman in a light which I don't think he should be cast in. But let's tell me the story first, and then we will I'll explain what I'm talking about. By the way, for those who want more details of them, Lawrence Kaplan, has a great article that appeared in Modern Judaism. It's called From Cooperation to Conflict, Rabbi Professor Emanuel Rachman, Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and the Evolution of American Modern Orthodoxy. What he has in this article is the sort of stuff I would have done had I ever written a biography. But I have material which I'll share, which I have from Rachman himself. By the way, Kaplan thinks that the Rav becomes more conservative in his philosophy in halakha. Not sure if that's the case, but he's definitely right that Rachman becomes more radical. But what Kaplan does say is that some of the ideas you see in the Rav's early writings on halakha, for example, his letter on the chaplaincy that I am going to deal with when we deal with the Alfgott book, are really not, they're what you might call a teleological approach to halakha. That's what Rachman has. That is that you're trying to get to a certain goal. And that doesn't seem to fit with the Rav's later writings on halakha. In fact, Kaplan makes a very interesting point that he says, as the Rav moves on in years, you have a growing emphasis in the Rav's philosophy on the religious value and the importance of sacrifice. We're going to see that, I think, right now. Sacrifice for the yoke of halakha. And that really takes some of the edge off the inability of poskim to find solutions for burning halakhic problems, because that's part of the religious ethos of traditional Judaism, that you have to sacrifice. And although we saw already in his letter to the RCA, he mentioned that he doesn't have all the problems. But the idea that you're stuck with problems and halacha can't solve everything, just like theodicy, you know, can't solve everything. Okay, so what's the issue I'm talking about here? Well, in the 60s, Rabbi Rachman, and then it comes to fruition really in the 70s, Rabbi Rachman was looking at this, the issue of the aguna. And he was convinced that a solution needed to be found and that a solution can be, could be found to solve the problem of the aguna. We all know the classic aguna is when the husband disappears and we don't know where he is. But what we usually refer to as aguna today is the husband doesn't want to give the get. So the wife can't remarry, so she's bound to him, so she's an aguna. The sages in the Talmud, and I'll show you the Gemara, the classic Gemara in a second, they have this principle that in Aramaic it's called Tavo Metav Tandum El Metav Armala, that a woman would rather be married than be single. And she'd rather be married to pretty much anyone. Now, it's true that later they will make distinctions. They will, that's like a basic statement, and then they whittle it down a little. Already in the Gemara, they speak about, would a woman really want to marry a tanner? Those who've been with us to Morocco, one of the places we go to, you can see what it's like with the smell that, you know, with the leather. But so already the Gemara deals with that. And then you have the issue of, well, let's say the man is impotent. The early Achronim deal with that. There were some who thought, incidentally, that even an impotent man, she'd rather be married to him. She's not Mechuyev and Pruervu. She'd rather, but this most poskim assume that impotence is the something that is the exception. Ramosha Feinstein extends this even more. Find other examples. In fact, Rachman writes a very important, to this day, an important article in the 60s when the Igros Moshe on Eben Ezra comes out, and he sees Rav Moshe as really charting the way, because Rav Moshe was very brave in finding ways to annul marriages that other poskim did not want to do. And Rav Moshe used this idea that a mekach tos, when the woman married, she never would have married had she known this about the guy or that about the guy. But that becomes the dispute. How wide can you open this? And Rabbi Rachman, who incidentally would later be attacked by Rav Moshe for going too extreme, Rabbi Rachman's position was that we do have an opening here, because the whole idea that a woman would rather be married than be single, he says, if you look around today, you see that's not the case. All you have to do is look at the Upper West Side. You look around, and we know that women wouldn't just marry any guy. They're not going to marry to someone, just like a man wants someone who there's compatibility. A woman would rather be single than marry someone who she's not compatible with. Now, I'll show you the Gemara right now, but before I get to that, many of you know the story that how the Rav would attack Rachman on this. The letter, which we're going to read about, which I have, is the Rav reflecting on how difficult it was, but he thought he had to do it. But before I even get to that, as many of you know the basic outlines of the story, and subsequent to the Rav attacking Rachman, Rachman was then even regarded by many Orthodox as really out of the fold, how he could say these things. I just gave you two examples to show that it's really not fair, it's not true, that what the Rachman said, even if it's not accepted, is not some crazy thing from left field. Basically, what Rachman was saying is that we have to revisit this chazaka, and then that would lead us for more liberality in terms of saying like mekach tos. Rachman would later go to an extreme that I don't think there's any halachic basis. So for instance, and I spoke to Rachman about this, by the end of his life, and this was the basis of his Beis Din, what Rachman said, Rabbi Rachman, was that any man who refuses to give his wife a get, the Beis Din could annul the marriage. And the reason for this, and I discussed this with Rabbi Rachman, was that And this is what Rackman said, and he, in conversation, he explained it to me, but this was his approach. You don't need me to tell you this. This was the approach of the Basin. He said that any man who refuses to give his wife a get is cruel, is evil. And therefore, had the woman known this, that he had such characteristics, she never would have married him. The very fact that he refuses to give the get shows he's evil. And had she known that this evilness, she never would have married him. Therefore, it's a mekach tos. So I said to Rackman, I don't get this. What are you talking about? I said that maybe the only reason he's not giving her the get is because he hates her now because they're getting divorced. But not that he's inherently, you know, not that 5 years ago when they got married, this was it. But now he hates her, so he's acting evil. And Rackman said, no. He said, this is what he said to me. I don't know if he ever wrote this, but he said to me, he said, speak to any psychologist. They'll tell you that this characteristic, this evil in this man was there from the beginning. It's not just that all of a sudden, because he's in a difficult divorce, he's going to take revenge against her, that this is a characteristic of him that was always there that has now come out. So I'm not a psychologist. If you have psychologists, you could tell me, but that was Rackman's position, which basically means that you can annul any marriage that the husband refuses to give a get. All these issues that we have that Ora has to protest in front of the houses, and all of the problem we have with the Aguna, we won't have this at all, because all these manuvalim who refuse to give their wives a get, we can just annul the marriage, and end of story. Now, we have examples. Again, Rav Moshe did it. We have in Philadelphia, Rav Kamenetsky or Nata Greenblatt, they annulled a marriage. But these are like ad hoc, you know, cases here and there, where Rabbi Rackman said that now we have a general rule that in every case we can do this, basically. And we never had this before. And Rabbi Rackman's position was that this is an example where psychology gives us insights, where now we understand things that we didn't understand before. And this gives us an opening. And the whole opening, this is really moving way beyond his basic idea that no woman wants to be married to just any guy. And this is really moving beyond that into really just massive voidings of kiddushin, but it goes back to this principle. Okay, so what do I mean though when I say that Rabbi Rackman is then portrayed, you know, as reformist? If you want to use those terms with those later based in, I don't disagree with it. I don't agree with that theory either, but I don't think it has halachic validity. But his original position is not so out of bounds as you find as it's. In the way many posts can speak about these matters. But let me just give you two examples, which I think illustrate this. In, I guess it was around 94, maybe 95, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was in Newton, Massachusetts, staying at his daughter and son-in-law's house. So I went to see him. I came with a whole list of questions. I've said some of the questions in the past. Since we're dealing with the Rav, one of the questions I asked him was, what are we supposed to do with the Debrecener Rav or Moshe Stern? The Debrecener Rav said such terrible things about the Rav. And he says, you shouldn't quote him. You shouldn't. Okay, but I we'll get back to Rav Aaron, because the letter that Chakira refused to publish, the halachic letter of the Rav, I discussed it with Rav Aaron as well. Okay, so the conversation was me, one of Rav Aaron's Talmidim who brought me to him, and at the beginning, most of it was just us, and it was only me speaking. But for the first 5 minutes, there was this other rabbi there who, until today, I didn't understand. I don't want to say who they are. I didn't understand it, but now I do, because this is sort of famous. There was a modern Orthodox rabbi. Many people will know who it is if I would say the name, who was also there. He was there before me. But he didn't know what I'm going to tell you now. And I was wondering today, how could anyone not know this? If you went to YU, he's around 60 years old now. But I looked him up. He didn't go to YU. So he's a rabbi, Marder Shul. He didn't go to YU. Okay, so the first question I asked Rav Aaron, I phrased it something, and I have this. I copied, you know, I took notes. I always am afraid I'll forget, so I write down my conversations. I said to Rav Aaron, while this rabbi was still there, I don't know why he was still there. I guess it was my time. He should have left, but whatever. He was still there. I said, I want to speak about the idea of Tavol Meitav Dandu, Mil Meitav Armo, that woman would rather, the Talmudic assumption that a woman would rather be married to anyone, basically, than be single. And that why should it apply today when you look out and you see the Metzius? And this rabbi says, before Avraham responds, he says, well, obviously it shouldn't apply today. In other words, he assumed that, of course, it's a davar pashut, that of course it shouldn't apply today. Without knowing the controversy or anything, he just expressed an opinion, the exact same opinion of Rabbi Rachman. So then Rav Aaron said, no, no, no. Rav Aaron says, that was what Rabbi Rachman said, and my brother showed how that he's wrong. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik would always refer to, they wouldn't call him the Rav, he'd call him my brother. So I think that this is a good example of how, if without knowing what the Rav said, and had the Rav never said this, you wouldn't have thought what Rabbi Rachman said is so weird or out of bounds. Proof number one, that this leading rabbi, not a YU rabbi, immediately assumed that what Rabbi Rachman said was correct, not knowing Rabbi Rachman said it. Once he heard Rabbi Rachman said it, then all of a sudden, oh, of course, it's puzzle. But before he knew it was Rabbi Rachman, he thought it made sense. The second example is that I had a conversation with a leading student of the Rav. And when I say a leading student of the Rav, again, I don't have permission to cite the names of people who are still alive, so I won't. But let's just say we're not talking about some liberal modern Orthodox. We're not talking about, there's a lot of Talmidim of the Rav. I'm talking about one of the top Talmidim of the Rav that every single person listening to us knows. Top, you know, think of the top couple of them. Well, let's just leave it at this. And he said to me as follows, quote, he said, I never discussed this with the Rav. And then he said, and I don't know if he'd want me to say this publicly, that's why I'm not saying who. He said, and I don't understand the Rav's position. He said, why should this be any different than any other chazakah? Chazakah is based on the Metzius. If today we look around and women aren't, he said, I don't understand why this chazakah should be any different than other chazakahs. So here you have someone from the top of the Rav's Talmidim who said to me in private conversation that he himself doesn't understand this. I'm not saying he didn't accept it. The Rav said it, he accepts it. But he said he doesn't understand it. And he never spoke to the Rav about this, but he doesn't know why Rabbi Rachman's not correct, why this chazaka should be any different than any other chazakas. We're going to see what the Rav says. And he knew what the Rav said. But so I just give you these two examples to show that I think Rabbi Rachman has been caricatured falsely as coming up with some, crazy idea. If in the end we don't accept it because of the Rav, fine. But it's not like what he said is so far out. And there's halachic sources. They don't exactly say what Rabbi Rachman says, but you can interpret it that way. And just to give you one final example, I don't know if this source will mean anything to you, but for some of you it might. I'm holding this book. It's called Avo Beitecha from Rav David Stav or Rav Avram Stav. Father-son team. Rav David Stav, he almost was chief rabbi, or at least the religious Zionist world wanted him to be chief rabbi. He's the Rav of Shoham, a big Talmud Chacham, a real religious Zionist, and a moderate religious Zionist. It seems that they're hard to come by. If you don't know what I'm talking about, look at Smotrich's latest stunt today, and then he's in Paris. But and Rav Avram Stav, his son, who's also a Talmud Chacham, so it's very nice. Father-son put it together. But this is a book. It's on Shelos HaTshuvos regarding family matters. Evan Ezer. On page introduction, page 27, he's speaking about this matter, and he expresses a view different from the Rav. He says as follows, in note 21, he says, he mentions Tavel Meitav Tandu, and then he says, but if you have a certain chazaka that doesn't reflect Metzius, there's no problem in being mevatelit. And then he says, Amnam Yaduim Divrego and Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik. He says it's well known what Rabbi Soloveitchik says. He says that this is a chazaka, a different type of chazaka from Yemei Bereishis that can never be changed. But this is what Rav Stav says. Rav Stav's a Dayan. He's a Talmud Chacham. He's not a reformist. Rav Stav says, Uam Kasha Lahavin Estevarav. It's difficult to understand the Rav's position. Shekain, b'mesh shone chazaka zo meches chazakot achayrot. How is this chazaka different than other chazakot? Hamuskar patalmud. In other words, exactly what the Rav's big Talmud told me. That so you see here that it's not just Rabbi Rachman, but others will also. And I struggle with this. So after we go through it, if someone can explain, is this just? Is the Rav being moved by meta-halachic factors? Is it the challenge of feminism? Is the Rav afraid of what Rabbi Rachman and people like him are going to end up doing, which they did? Or is it really just this matter per se? I'm not really sure because I have the same issues that others had. So let's look at some of the sources, and then I'm going to read, or the major source, and then I'm going to read you passages from the Rav. Then we'll get to the letter. But what the Rav, he never did something like this. Attack someone in public like this. It wasn't the Rav's way. And Rabbi Rachman afterwards wrote an essay on this, or a little article, and he said that later the Rav said to him, he said, you look, well, I'll read it to you. he said, in Shema in 1985, Rachman published it. He says, you look at the halacha historically, and I look at it meta-historically. So that's, and it's true, the Rav didn't look at it historically, and Rachman did look at it historically. So Rachman says, what for the Rav was a presumption as stated by the sages, he said this was a statement of an ideal, not a statement of fact. And then he says, but the Rav couldn't explain why this chazaka different from other chazakas. And Rachman says, quote, I was quite certain that in the modern age, many women would prefer no marriage to a bad one. Certainly, the question was deserving of a new look. And as with many other presumptions, a change might be in order. Many famous halachic authorities agreed with me. Well, they did agree with him in individual cases, like Rav Moshe, but not necessarily to get rid of the chazaka in its entirety. Incidentally, since I mentioned that it's this piece of Rabbi Soloveitchik that some have seen as dooming Rachman's candidacy, I have to tell you that Rachman told me that I cannot believe this. I do not believe it's true. But he said that the Rav supported him for presidency of Yeshiva University. I mean, there's stories how Chaim Soloveitchik spoke against the Rav. But I cannot believe that. But he said it's true. He said you can ask the family. Now, I don't think it's true, but the fact that Rachman thought it was true, and remember, they still had a good relationship even after the attack. Zelachud v'zelachud, as we say, one the other. And they were not hard feelings. It was a dispute. Okay, so let me begin by showing you the... you wouldn't be surprised if I told you that the Haredim reprinted the Rav's talk as a way to give it to Rachman. It's in Bava Kama 110b. It deals with a case. Well, it's right now, just reading it. So the Gemara says, if that's the case, if that is so, then what if a case of a woman whose husband died childless, who happened before her late husband's brother, who was afflicted with boils? So this woman's brother-in-law, who has to do yibum with her, he has boils. So who wants to be with someone who has boils? So the question is, should she go free without being required to perform the ritual? Why? Because she never betrothed herself with the intention of having anything to do with a guy with boils. In other words, when she got married to her brother, she got married to her husband, knowing that the guy has boils, she never intended that she'd have any connection to him. And the Gemara said to us that... they conclude no, and at the end here's the famous expression because Reish Lakish says Tavo Meitav Tandu Milo Meitav Armelu. It's better to sit as two bodies as he married than to sit lonely as a widow. And and the Gemara says that even had she known about the boils, it wouldn't have mattered. She still would have married him, the man she married to, because. But, you know, the fact that the guy has boils, that's not a problem. That's better than being single. So Now, how far you take this, that's the question. In fact, Rav Moshe thinks that really that's only referring to Yavoma, that you get married to someone knowing that maybe you'll fall, you know, what are the odds that you're going to have to do Yibum or Chalitza with someone who has boils? The odds are unlikely, but that's not the same as marrying them. Okay, so Rabbi Rachman, as I mentioned, he spoke for the RCA and elsewhere, saying that this principle, we need to update this principle. It clearly doesn't apply anymore today. Women only want to get married to people they don't want. It's not like in the olden days where you needed to marry to be protected. That's why marriage was so important. Women didn't have careers, they had money. Polygamy, the whole idea of polygamy was so that women, there was always less women than men. Men are out fighting wars and doing these things. So a woman has to be part of a clan. So you need to marry her. So you need to have a polygamous system to make sure everyone's taken care of. In a pre-modern, pre-romantic society, that's understandable. So Rabbi Rachman said it's not true. And Rabbi Rachman said, look at the world. Just look around and you see it's not true. So the Rav felt that he needed to respond. Because I guess he felt that Rachman, as a leading modern Orthodox rabbi, was getting traction. And if you say that the chazaka doesn't apply, then that gives you the ability to start voiding marriages and without gittin. Now, it's true. If Moshe Feinstein does it, he's the posek ador. He can do it. But you're going to let Rabbi Emanuel Rachman and his friends decide that you can start voiding marriages? That's too much. So I want to read you some of what the Rav said. And then we're going to see the letter where the Rav reflects on why he felt he had to. It's 1975, and the Rav decides that he has to speak publicly about this at the RCA convention. And I'll just read you some of the lines, some of the sections where the Rav. Now, I don't know. Unfortunately, I didn't ask Rabbi Rachman this. I would love to know, was Rabbi Rachman in the room when this occurred? I find it hard to believe that the Rav would have said what he said with Rachman sitting right there. But I never asked him, so I don't. And you could say, if it's Torah, you got to say it no matter where. But, okay, so this is 1975. And by the way, the Rav, he was giving a shiur on Geirus. And then he went off and or he began speaking about something else because he thought it was important. He says as follows, quote, we have a whole transcript. We have two transcripts, actually. They're basically the same, and you can hear it online. Before I start, I would like to discharge another duty. Believe me, I do it with sadness in my heart. You know me. I have never criticized anybody, never attacked anybody, and I have never set myself up as judge and arbiter to approve or disapprove of statements made by others. We know that. We saw even with Yitz Greenberg, the Rav didn't condemn him. The Rav said to him, I wouldn't go speak for the interfaith group, but if you go, if you think you want to do it, then I wish you the best. And he never attacked him publicly. However, today I feel it is my duty to make the following statement, and I'm very sad I have to do it. But somehow I have no choice in the matter. There is no alternative. What I'm going to say, I want you to understand, is my credo about Torah and the way Torah should be taught and Torah should be studied. You know, if Yitz Greenberg, Rabbi Greenberg, wants to on his own go and have an interfaith gathering, it doesn't really affect anyone else. But what Rabbi Rachman was talking about was about altering the way halacha functions. I guess that's something that the Rav thought he needed to speak about. And then he goes on. He begins by saying that he's been a Rosh Yeshiva his entire life. He's taught many people. He talks about how Torah has a great impact on him, that he feels rejuvenated. He comes out of a long shiur. The 25, 30-year-old students are all tired, and he comes out, and he feels rejuvenated. He's all, working up to what he's going to say. He talks about how, I'm not sure why he goes into all this detail. He talks about how busy his schedule is, that he's giving shiur in New York, and then he comes back to Boston. He says in Boston, every Friday morning from 8:30 for 3 hours to 11:30, he studies with his son-in-law. That's Professor Yitzhak Torsky. He says on Shabbos, he doesn't take a nap, and he hasn't taken a nap for 20 years. Why? Because he studies with Moshe, that's Moshe Torsky, 3 hours, and then he studies with Meir Torsky, 2.5 hours. And then he talks about how he has little time. And then he starts speaking about how the cathartic impact, the Rav liked the word cathartic, even has an essay called Catharsis. The importance of Torah, it's not just an intellectual thing. It's the intellect is obviously important, but it's more than intellectual. It's total. It's all encompassing. He's trying to create a sense of what Torah study is, that it's not just something intellectual. I can't go through all of this. It goes on. It's a wonderful talk. He says, the study of Torah is an ecstatic metaphysical performance. The study of Torah is an act of surrender. That's going to be important, this idea of surrender. And then he speaks out. What does it mean to surrender? What does Kabbalah Soma Chushamayim require of the person who's studying Torah? And he speaks about that we are all in the path of the Chachmei Masorah. I believe the Rav coined this expression. Chachmei Masorah. Yes, we have the phrase Chachmei Masorah for a long time, but everyone else who uses Chachmei Masorah, they're referring to the Masoretes, the ones in Tiberias and in Bavel that decided on the trup and on the punctuation. When the Rav uses the term, and this has become like a standard YU term now, Chachmei HaMasorah, he's referring to those who are in this the path of tradition. The authentic Torah path from Rabbi Akiva through the Gaonim, through the Rambam, through the Achronim, going down. And that's the Rav's point here, that we need everything we do in Torah study. It's not like an academic thing where you can come up with your new ideas and overturn things. That's fine in the academic world. But in Torah, you need to be part of this tradition. And then he says, that when it comes to issues of ideology, understanding of Torah, he says the final authorities are the Chachmei HaMasorah. He says they can be Tanaim, they can be Amoraim, they can be Rishonim, it doesn't matter. They're the final authorities. And he even says that, he says, I don't like to say it, it's a little harsh, but I'm not saying it, the Rambam says it. He says, if you make an irresponsible statement about Chazal, he says, you are bordering on the heresy. Why? Because the Rambam says about the Sadducees. He says to them that in Hilchos Tshuva, he says, if you deny the Torah Shabbat Peh, which you know the Sadducees do, l'hamachish magideha. What is l'hamachish magideha? It means, in other words, it's not just denying the Torah Shabbat Peh puts you in the category of heresy, but if you also deny the transmitters of the Masorah, say that they don't have the authority. Like you can say we believe in Torah Shabbat Peh, but Rabbi Akiva or Rashi, the Rambam, they're not the authentic transmitters. He says it borders on heresy. Why does he say it borders on heresy? If Rambam says it is heresy, because I think what he's saying is it's not just the Tanaim. Yes, if you said about Tanaim or Amoraim, that's heresy. But even if you say it about the Rishonim and Achronim, you're going to say the Vilna Gaon has no authority to decide halacha? That's machish magideha. And then he says, okay. And then, so after saying all this, now, which, if Rabbi Rachman could say, this is neither here nor there, because he's not denying any of this. But the Rav sets the stage, and then he says, let me add something that is very important. Not only the halachas, but also the chazakas, which Chachmei Chazal have introduced, are indestructible. We must not tamper, not only with the halachos, but even with the chazakos. For the chazakos of which Chazal spoke rests not upon transient psychological behavior patterns, but upon permanent ontological principles rooted in the very depth of the human personality, in the metaphysical human personality, which is as changeless as the heavens above. The Rav says that when Chazal established this principle, and he's going to elaborate on this, it's a permanent principle. It's about the nature of humanity, of womanhood, let's call it, which doesn't change. He says, let's take the example of the chazaka I was told about. It has absolutely nothing to do with the social and political status of women in antiquity. This chazaka is not based upon sociological factors, but upon a verse in Bereishis. The verse that says, I will greatly multiply thy pain, thy travail, your desire shall be for your husband. It's a metaphysical curse rooted in the feminine personality. She suffers incomparably more than the male who is in solitude. He says a man can be in solitude. He can make do with it. But for a woman, it is much more terrible an experience. This is not a psychological fact, he says. It's an existential fact, which is not due to the inferior status of the woman, but rather the difference, the basic distinction between the female personality and the male personality. Loneliness frightens the woman. An old spinster's life is much more miserable and tragic than the life of an old bachelor. This was true in antiquity. It is today true, and it will be true 1,000 years from now. Just getting started with the Rav. He has more to say about this. So why, though? Why should this chazaka be different than other chazakas? Because the Rav says that the chazakas, he says the chazakas of Chazal are never changing, but he's not referring to all the chazakas, because certain chazakas are clearly changing. All the Rishonim deal with that. He's talking about certain chazakas, which reflect, ontological reality, existential reality. How do you know which is which? How do you know? So we have to get into more detail of what the Rav, because I see I'd like to continue. I don't want to stop right now, but we have two more columns here. Wait till the Rav really. The Rav says to speak about this at a rabbinical convention about changing, this chazaka is like speaking communism at a Republican National Convention. I mean, one of the Rosh Hashiva uses language like that. But so there's a lot more to do about this. And then the private side, the letter I saw. And like I said, I'd love for some insight for some of our listeners, both live and not. Is this Harah Ladorus Lerov, or this is more of like a Harah Shah, where the Rav sees the danger of Rabbi Rachman's position and he's arguing a point more polemically as opposed to factually. I'm not sure that the claim has been made that this is really motivated by the great danger he saw in the change of halakha, because really at the end of the day, you can make the claim, really who cares whether the chazaka is permanent or not? That's neither here nor there. You could say the real issue is halakha. Are we going to start changing halakha? Because even if you say the chazaka is not permanent, does that give you the right then to start just basically get rid of the laws of Gittin? Each case would still need to be looked at independently, like Ramosha did. But Rabbi Rachman's idea was that we saw what happened when he opened up his Beis Din. And I don't know if he had this idea then, but he certainly had it later, that the very fact that a man refuses to give a get is itself proof that he has a flaw. And no woman would marry such a man. And you can't say she would, Katava Metatandu, because that's no longer a principle. Ergo, there no longer is an Aguna issue. We can free every Aguna today. No one ever said that before in history. No Rishon, no Acharon. Granted, throughout history, most of the Agunas are the ones who ship went down, and we don't know where they are. But we also had plenty of cases in the past where guys refused to give a wife a get. The Achronim have dealt with this matter, and not one of them ever came up with this idea that, it just shows that the guy's a jerk and the woman never would have married him. Maybe they felt like I thought, he's a jerk because he's involved in the feud, or maybe you tell a woman, how many times do you tell someone you shouldn't marry this person, he's trouble, and they marry him anyway. So you're going to say all these marriages are not valid? We still need to see the Rav, because the Rav has, I happen to think this is one of the most important expressions of the Rav's understanding of halakha, is faced with these modern controversies. As far as I know, you can find it on the internet and other places, but it hasn't been reprinted as far as I know in any of the writings of the Rav. If I'm wrong on that, please let me know. So let me get to some of the questions here. Sorry to stop in the middle of this. Mark says, the comment about whether Reb Chaim gave shir and gave psak underscores something that is lost in America. Three roles: the Rav of the town, Posek, the Avestan, and the Rosh Hashiva were three separate roles and kept apart. It's only in the U.S. that we expect Shul Mari Dasar to function as all three. I don't know, Mark. I mean, generally, the Rav was also the Avestan.
I didn't mean general. I didn't mean it to come out as general as that. Just because somebody a few minutes later said pretty much it was wrong. But in general, in Europe, those things were kept separate. And here they're not.
Well, in Europe, the Rosh Yeshiva was kept separate from the Rav. The Rosh Yeshiva were never poskim. Every great posek in Europe was a Rav. And even the Rosh Yeshiva, like the Netziv, he was the Rav of Lodzin, the city. But the Rav was the posek. You write as if there's three roles. We have three roles in America because we have pulpit rabbis, we have poskim, and we have Rosh Yeshiva. And sometimes now they're all three, the Rosh Yeshiva. But in Europe, you only had two roles. You only had the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rav, because the every local rabbi would have to give psak on local matters. They weren't national poskim. And then you had the great poskim, but the great poskim were also rabbanim. And then you had dayanim.
But you didn't have
in Europe like a pulpit rabbi like we have, who only like would visit the sick. And if you had a shiloh, you'd ask, because most towns were a little shul. And Reb Chaim was unique in that. The Aruch HaShulchan, by the way, disagreed with Reb Chaim. The Aruch HaShulchan said the major role of a Rav is to paskin shilas. Unlike Reb Chaim.
I was thinking of that that's a well-known story that Reb Chaim asked Reb Pesach and said, you made a Pesach, not your Svara.
Yes, that's from Reb Sochanan. Because Reb Chaim was unique in this, and that he hired a dayan, Rav Simcha Zelig, Rav Govsky's grandfather. But Rav Moshe was a Rav in a city in Chasavich. He had to paskin. And in fact, when Rav Moshe Soloveitchik went to Chasavich, Rav Chaim, the first thing he said to him was actually one of these sort of subversive psukim of Rav Chaim. He says, when it comes to Yom Kippur, ignore the Shulchan Aruch's ruling of feeding them Pachas Kashir. You had to paskin. By the way, that psak of Reb Chaim was one of the ones he insisted on in Brisk. But Reb Moshe had the paskin. He was only the Rav of this, but Reb Chaim was able to get a dayan. And again, Reb Zevin, unfortunately, hasn't been translated to English. His Ishim Vishitot, but there's a great, great essay on Reb Chaim there. Yes, and Nissen says the small town Rav ran a cheder in yeshiva. Well, by the 19th century, Nissen, the local rabbanim didn't really have yeshivas. Traditionally, in the 18th century and before, the local rav would have a little yeshiva. However many, sometimes would be big. However many the Balabatim could afford 50 students, it'd have 50. If they could afford 10, it'd have 10. But by the 19th century, you didn't have that. Yeshivas really became independent of the local rav. Danny says Renato Greenbaum was not part of the annulment. He accepted that psak and remarried the affected woman. Well, that means he's part of it, I would say. He didn't just close his eyes. He relied on the psak that was given him by Rabbi Kamenetsky. Okay, but I assume he looked at it, and he has to take responsibility too. If he's being any rabbi who's a Masada Kedushin, has to, and I know people who called up Rav Nutto. And so, I mean, I have to assume he's a great posek. He was convinced that you say he was just misled or something. I assume whatever it is, he did the marriage. So he was part of the annulment. Who says it's a bad annulment? Maybe it's a good annulment. I don't know. David says, Rabbi Rachman's position seems to be based on the popular yet unscientific belief that marriages fail when husbands wish for their wives to never change and for wives to clutch onto the notion that men will change. Oh, very cute, David. What I would like to know, though, is from our psychologist, is Rabbi Rachman correct? This was a dispute I had with him. Is it true that someone who's a jerk and won't give his wife a get, was that bad character trait always there? Or maybe now that they're killing each other in the court, that's why he won't do it. Rabbi Rachman says, he says, ask the psychologist, they'll tell you. Well, Rav Moshe dealt with this outside that, you know, if someone has a real psychological problem and gets mad and you marry him and you didn't know about it, that could be grounds for Mekach Taos. Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg gives an example of Mekach Taos. He says, if a woman marries a guy and she didn't know that he was a Meshumad, He converted to Christianity, and then he converted back to Judaism. Rabbi Weinberg says no kosher Bas Yisrael would ever marry someone who was a Meshumad, even for a short period of time. So he thinks that's a Mekachtos. David Eisen says, Rabbi Kefet has quoted the Rav in his classes as saying that Tavla Meitav is different from other Chazakot because it's ontological. Yes, we saw that. We saw that with the Rav. We're going to read more. The question is why, though? And Rabbi Rakefet says they spoke with Avraham Lichtenstein, who said he disagreed with the Rav. Okay, well, I can tell you that Rav Lichtenstein is not the Talmud I spoke to about this. The Talmud I spoke to about this is still alive, but of the same level as Rav Lichtenstein, put it that way. So it's interesting. So, but what does that mean, Rav Lichtenstein? So I guess that means Rav Lichtenstein would be more willing to be mevatel, to annul certain marriages, if you don't have that principle. It's been argued that Rav Moshe could not have agreed with the Rav, because Rav Moshe's whole approach of annulling marriages assumes that Tavel Meitav Tandu is generally not accepted in a whole, you know, range of cases. So although Rav Moshe never says in these words that this chazaka can change, if you look at his tshuva, how we deal with these cases, and he says, well, in this case, she never would have married him. In this case, she never would have married him. If you add it up, you basically are concluding that that Rav Moshe really doesn't buy it as an ontological principle. I don't see how else to read Rav Moshe. Rabbi Kelman says, I think this is similar to the Rav's extreme position on Mechitza, which is also very questionable halachically. By the way, when we get to the letters of Rabbi Nehefgott volume, I'll reveal something that isn't very well known, that comes from none other than Rav Schachter, that shows that Rav Soloveitchik's known position on Mechitza was more nuanced, and at other times he was not so extreme on that case. But you say, Rabbi Kelman, there are often factors beyond halacha that are work. No different than a Chasam Sofer saying a minhag has the status of Torah law. And there have been people who have said exactly what you said, Rabbi Kelman, that the Rav's real fear here was where Rabbi Rachman was going to take all this. But the fact is, though, the Rav is using language of ontological, and this is a chazaka, is he just making this up for propaganda? No. So, I mean, you need to explain his language here. So we got to work on this a little. Zahav says, in 2023, if someone was assumed to the Rav, are they still bound by the Rav after the Rav passed away? I don't know what that means, bound by. You ask a shaila, but the Rav had certain hanhagos. He never insisted that everyone followed his hanhagos. And I think, though, this is a big one. You know, the Rav, I think on this one, you would be bound by the Rav. Although, look, I don't know what Rav Lichtenstein meant. Rav Lichtenstein meant he's bound by the Rav, but he doesn't agree with it. That's also, you can say that I don't accept it. You know, I don't understand it. I don't believe it, but halacha l'maisa, I follow it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I would think that a student of the Rav would be, if the Rav spoke so publicly about this, I think you'd be bound by that. okay. Ruth says that the shoe were on the other foot and the get was in the hands of the woman to give, the sages and their descendants will be singing a completely different song. Okay, well, the Rav, I hate to say it, Ruth, the Rav would say that's machish magideha. That doesn't mean you need to agree with the Rav, but the Rav felt that that sort of sociologizing is conservative Judaism. That's he felt that he didn't think that, and yes, Rabbi Rachman might. I don't know about Rabbi Rachman, but Eliezer Berkovitz would agree maybe with what you said, but the Rav would see this as unacceptable. But I understand that's from the feminist critique, even the Orthodox feminist critique, that's that point is often made. David says, does the Rav believe that Tavla Meitav Tandu is prescriptive or descriptive? It's prescriptive. It's descriptive. Sorry. It's not prescriptive. It's saying what the reality is. It's not prescribing what the reality should be. Chazal, these questions might have been asked before I actually read the words of the Rav. The Rav says that Chazal are telling us the nature of men and the nature of women, and that this is an inherent eternal nature. That is, it can't change. And I'm not sure why that becomes Nikar Amuna to say that the natures of women can't change over time. I don't know. I would have loved to speak to the Rav about this. And I spoke to Rav Aaron about it, but I have to say, Rav Aaron didn't really, I spoke to two people. I spoke to the big Talmud of the Rav, and the big Talmud of the Rav said to me, he doesn't understand it. And I spoke to Rav Aaron, and Rav Aaron really, he just repeated what the Rav said. He didn't clarify it for me anymore. So, you know, in Kabbalah Nekadel, I accept it, but I don't, I find it hard to understand, especially with what we know about psychology today. It's tough for me. I wouldn't be able to explain this to non-Orthodox Jews or even many Orthodox Jews because they wouldn't buy it. They just wouldn't, it doesn't sound right to them in the 21st century because you look around and you see that you just got to go to the Upper West Side. You see that's not true. David says, does the Rav, so what Rachman said, the Rav says, it doesn't matter what they're doing in the Upper West Side. It's like the famous talk about Pesach. the Rav Paskin about a certain thing, I forget what it was, maybe it was toothpaste, I think it was. You don't have to get kosher Pesach toothpaste because it's not Rali Lachios Kelef. So someone said to the Rav that this is a story, I don't know if it's true, but it's a good story, that his dog actually ate his toothpaste. And the Rav said, it doesn't change the halacha. If your dog is stupid and eats toothpaste, it doesn't change the fact that, it's not Rali Lachios Kelef. So the fact that you have all these women single and not want to get married, you could say, well, they just have the issues.
It doesn't change the whole thing. It was Meshuggah to Hunt.
Meshuggah to Hunt, yes. Okay, thank you, yes. Does the Rav espouse the same principles, David says, same attitude to other principles? Ein av meis panim, Rav bilos achar abal. I don't know. I don't think so, because in many of these, the Rishonim already, and definitely the Achronim say it doesn't apply. So I don't know. And Chaim says, what about following in the footsteps of conservative Judaism? Is that intensifying the Rav's position? That's the claim has been made as such. But then you have to deal with, what about the Rav's statement? The Rav's saying he's developing a whole theory here of the woman's nature. You're saying he's just saying this as to put up like a shield against conservative Judaism? No, the Rav is convinced. Maybe subconsciously this is pushing the Rav, but it's definitely not consciously. The Rav is convinced that this is eternal. And Ruth says, as long as we lived in a coercive autonomous society, as Rabbi David Katzo put it, the Beis Din could force the man to give the get. So the jerk husband was taken care of. Now that we do not live with Batei Din that have any teeth, the situation is different. There's nothing to compel such a person to do the right thing. So should he risk his aguna's wife taking out a contract on his life? Look, you're correct. And unless you live in Satmar today, where they have their goon squad and they can take care of it, there's really no way to force these people to give a get. And unfortunately, you have these unscrupulous rabbis who will give a heter meir rabbanim. And shuls, don't take it seriously sometimes. You know, if the shul of my shul says the guy can't come in, the other shul will let him in. And the answer is, I will say, the RCA's prenuptial agreement. I've been told by people in the RCA that not one couple that has signed the prenuptial agreement has there ever been an aguna. But you have to sign it. And if you're in the Haredi world and they don't accept it, I don't really have the answer. I don't know. Okay, a couple more. Danny says that Berkowitz described a case where he tried to effect a divorce from a man hospitalized with mental illness during the Nazi era. During the Nazi-imposed difficulties, he could never accomplish the get. He expressed regret over not annulling on the basis of Mekach Talos due to mental illness. That's indeed the case. He discusses that in Not in Heaven. He mentions it, and that's in the Sri D.H. He deals with it with Yechiel Weinberg. And Eliezer Berkowitz was, together with Rabbi Rachman, they were the two most involved with the Saguna issue. And Eliezer Berkowitz wrote an entire book with the encouragement of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg to try to solve the Aguna problem, which we haven't solved. But as long as we do the prenuptial, we pretty much taken care of it. Someone says, well, what about, no, I'll leave the private comment. Michael says there's a difference in saying the nature of women hasn't changed and saying that circumstances haven't changed. The nature can be the same, but if circumstances change so that it's easier for women to be economically self-sufficient, that same nature may be less needed to be married. It makes sense, but the Rav thought differently. The Rav thought that this was something about women's nature. And I don't know, did the Rav ever speak to women to ask them about this? Or did Rav ever speak to his granddaughters about this? This also might be different depending on, you know, someone from the Rav's generation. That's very different than the 60s. The Rav would speak to college students. You speak to a college, you know, girl in the 60s. You know, that always is an issue when you describe something, if the people you describe don't recognize themselves in this. So I can imagine the Rav saying this to young women and the women saying, well, we don't recognize ourselves in this description. So then what is the Rav supposed to say? Well, you don't recognize it, but it really is true. It really is you. But then that runs the risk of paternalism. Then you are telling these people what really they believe. That was the criticism of Rav Kook. The irreligious are saying we reject religion because we want to create a new Jew. And Rav Kook says, well, really, you are religious. You don't realize it. You're really serving God's will, thinking you're in opposition to God's will. But that's paternalism. So we try to avoid paternalism today. So I can't really see how you can use this argument of the Rav today when women themselves, I'm not a woman, but I know that if you tell this to a woman, she will deny it. So how can anyone, even a woman, say this to another woman? Kava Homer, how can a man say it? It's a problem. I don't know, what can I say? Who am I to say anything? But the big Talmud of the Rav, he said to me, I don't understand it. So exactly. And we heard from David that Rav Lichtenstein said he doesn't understand it. So if we have to accept it, we accept it. Yes, Saruth?
Yeah. Right, because Tova Lichtenstein is his daughter-in-law, and Shoshana Schachter is both two strong-minded women, and their husbands have deferred. They won't say anything. And I'm sure I'm not sure. How do I know? I revere the Rav, but I can't go along with this, so I just want to just look the other way, just like the Rav, just like Rav Aaron.
I think you can say that at the end of the day, you don't need to accept the Rav's evaluation, which, as I said, it's hard to say if women themselves say it doesn't speak to them. But that doesn't mean the real issue here is where Rabbi Rachman was going with this. You can reject the Rav's evaluation of women, his description there, as Rabbi Stav does, without falling into the trap. And I believe it's a trap, because I think Rabbi Rachman, what he did was he went too far and was unprecedented. And I think at the end of the day, that's the important thing. Whether women's nature is that they need to be married or not, at the end of the day, who cares? The issue is, though, are you going to avoid marriages in a non-halachic fashion? I think that's the fundamental point. And I think, unfortunately, that's where Rabbi Rachman, with all his zechuyos, erred. And I think he erred in this, and I'll speak more next class, because of all the pressure and the fact that the whole Orthodox world was mevatel him and refused to hear him out. And since they refused to hear him out and even listen to his good points, he just basically said, the hell with this, and I'm going to just do what I want to do. Had they not thrown him out of Orthodoxy, basically, the way they did and pushed him on the extreme left, had they tried to deal with him, they could have come up, I think, with something more. Rabbi Broid wrote about this, you know, something of a more substantive, where you can find some ways to be mevatel get in certain areas, as opposed to just his, you know, with a wave of a hand, get rid of every single aguna. So I think that I think you don't need to accept the Rav entirely without falling into Rabbi Rachman's trap. And I really hope, anyone who knows me, it's hard to find someone with more respect than the Rav, for the Rav, than me. I mean, I'm sure many of you have the same respect. And I'm being honest with you. I'm talking about and I know I'm going to get some emails. I'm a chutzpahdik, I'm a mechutzof. Who am I to say? I'm not saying anything. I'm allowed to ask questions. Halacha l'maisa, of course, you're allowed. That's Zaken Mamre is one who halacha l'maisa goes against. You can ask a question and say, I don't understand this, but this is halacha, we follow it. But I'm allowed to ask the question. And And I think if you're honest, you see that the explanation, it's a difficult explanation, because the people who it's describing, women, and I've asked women, and I don't need to ask a lot of women. I know enough about women to know they will not describe themselves that way. And explanations that don't pass the test of the people being described, you know, that gets us into issues of paternalism, especially in this matter, when it's not like we have Rishonim or even Achronim who speak about this ontological idea that, granted, women were more apt to be married, but who says it's ontological, not just societal? So it's something I want to get back to. But despite that, I still think it's a really arousing essay of the Rav, and the idea machish magideha is, I think, quite important. I think you'd have to say that this is not an example of machish magideha, because remember, Chazal and Rishonim and Achronim never actually say this about the, unless you're going to say that it's machish magideha to question this of the Rav. But the idea of machish magideha, and that we are part of a tradition, the Chachmei HaMasorah, I think that's one of the most important things the Rav ever said. And I think that's really the most important lasting part of this essay, the idea that we can, you know, that people will say, well, you know, I'll accept the halacha, but, you know, the rabbis, you know, I don't need them. That I think is very important. So we'll just finally, the final comment, David says, the positive epilogue to this episode is that it led to Rabbi Rachman's Aliyah to serve as Chancellor of Bar Ilan and the establishment of the Rachman Center for the Advancements of the Status of Women. And yes, it's a good counter history. What would have happened had Rabbi Rachman become president, and would YU have changed it all? And so, but we're in the middle of this land. We're not finished. Maybe we haven't finished with the Rav. The Rav has a lot more to say. So maybe if you're not convinced yet, you'll be a little more convinced when I get through the next two columns. But Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, I'll defer all my comments since it's 9:53, and I won't say anything except I'll just say one thing, that a zaken mamre only applies to a beit din, a gadol. So as great as there's no such thing as a zaken mamre without the beit din, a gadol. So you know what? You can disagree with the Rav. I don't think it's the end of the world. And even if we're nobody, I mean, no halacha lemaisa. It's complex, as you say. We'll leave that for next week and other things. And for sure, his talmidim, who are great talmidim, do have the right to disagree, as they do on other issues. They don't accept the Rav for everything. So it's interesting here. I don't know that why they would have to accept the Rav here when they don't accept them on other issues. But let's leave that and wish everybody a Laila Tov. Everybody be well. If you haven't signed up for our Pesach program, which begins, I guess, Wednesday, Rabbi Alan Schwartz of Ohev Tzedek will be giving first Pesach Shir Wednesday at 2:00. That I think Dr. Mark left. It is very late. But next week, we're going to be on a new login. We're going to switch on Wednesday to the Pesach login. So even for this week, because once we switch, we're not going to switch back. So if you haven't signed up for the Pesach program, you're not going to get into class next week. So even though this class will be a regular class, but we'll send everybody the regular email, the updated email. But just to, you know, we switch every once in a while, we have to do that. So anyways, please do join us for many of our Pesach Yom. Tomorrow, Dr. Sokolow and Rabbi Shimon will be giving sort of the last for this part of their series. And then both of them will be giving a talk on Pesach in their regular time next week. Okay, we look forward to learning with you, and be well, and everybody invite a friend. And lots of food for thought, and Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laila Tov.